Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. Today's conversation may be a difficult one, so I want you to decide whether or not this is one that you would like to be involved with. Let me just tell you that my view of mental wellness includes the pursuit of new information and the active engagement in critical thinking. It is with that in mind that I approach today's conversation about suicide, what it is, what it isn't, what it was, and how we have treated it throughout history. Today's guest, Jennifer Michael Hecht, is a poet, philosopher, historian, and commentator. And she comes to this conversation about suicide from a very personal place. Jennifer Michael Hecht, welcome to Mind Talk. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
You talk about in your book, which is entitled Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It, some personal experiences that brought you to really think about and want to explore this idea. What were they?
Well, I lost an old friend to suicide, and it was incredibly painful, though not entirely mystifying to me, as I was going through some difficult times of my own when it happened. And so I was really coming out of a kind of depression where the thoughts of suicide had come to my mind. And then when I was starting to feel better, I got this news that an old friend had taken her life. And she was a poet too, and so we knew the same community, and online there was this outpouring of pain and grief, and I wrote a poem about it that kind of got passed around a lot, so I knew some of the ideas I was saying in that were useful to people. And then a little over a year later, less than 2 years, a mutual friend of ours, the woman who had taken her life, this mutual friend took her life. And it was then that I wrote an essay that I put online, really, for a small group of people. But it went viral, and even the Boston Globe wrote and asked if they could publish it in their print version. And that's when I heard from all of America writing and saying how scared they were for their adolescent son, or a man who had married this wonderful woman, and she had descended into this darkness, and he was just so scared. And it was one after another, people who'd already lost someone, people who were scared themselves, that they themselves were going to kill themselves because they had these thoughts. So I knew that, and most of them were just thanking me. They weren't even asking for anything. So it felt at that point, okay, because I'm a historian, I knew some of the connections I was making and made them somewhat off the top of my head in this little essay. Now it was time to go back and check all the connections and all the facts I was drawing on. And I definitely learned more in that process, and that became Stay. So it very much grew out of a personal experience, but the book itself is relatively it's full of historical and philosophical ideas that I felt were useful and that I desperately wanted to have between two covers of a book to share with someone else who might need them.
And, you know, it really is a fascinating history. And there are so many, just as a clinician, you know, I think about the clinical piece, but I don't think about, you know, what was said in days of old and how it was thought about and how it wasn't. So it really was a learning experience for me as well. One of the early pieces of information that you share in your book, Stay, which is stunning and depressing in and of itself, is when you let us know that approximately 30,000 people per year for the last 20 years have committed suicide.
Yeah, well, it was 20. It was in 2000. We hit. We checked and we hit 30,000, and we were shocked that the number had gotten so bad. And then in 2010, it hit 40,000. It was 39 and change. That's such a huge number. It's That means more Americans are killing themselves than most of the diseases, conditions, and dangers we talk about. In the last few years, it's been even up since then, so that in a few of the last few years, suicide outreached auto accidents as cause of death, which is just shocking for Americans.
Right.
And on college campuses, it outreached alcohol. And it's so frightening how, you know, you might be able to predict that your kid's a party animal and might be in danger of drinking too much when they go to school. But some of these university suicides, there's no warning. It's the beautiful, bright, talented, popular kid who goes, and if they've never done the work of thinking a little bit about what it means, they can get sucked into the same impulse that that older people get. I mean, it's pretty universal that our society has characterized suicide. So we think of it as always a sort of inevitable end to a biological disease called depression. And in fact, statistics and anecdotes all sort of show us real quickly that the people who do this are not always bedridden for years in and out of depression. Sometimes it really is a reversal in life, an impulse decision that you just don't have some protector from. And there's so many ways to protect yourself physically. Like, I mean, the easiest one is don't have a gun in the house. More than half of the suicides in this country are with guns, and more than half gun deaths in this country are suicide. So it's really quite extraordinary.
That's an astounding statistic. More than half of the suicides are gun deaths.
You know, in the UK, they were having trouble with Tylenol overdoses. They'd actually had a mini series that featured someone who killed themselves this way, and they'd been having trouble for a long time. So in the 90s, they stopped selling bottles of acetaminophen, changing it to these little bubble wraps of six at a time. Of course, you could go to different pharmacies and buy enough and take them out of the bubble wraps, but people didn't. The overall suicide rate dropped. So what that shows is that impulse is such a big part of this that if there's nothing nearby to control that impulse, you could be in trouble. But if you don't have any way to follow through, you very well might just plain get through the bad night and not have the impulse the next day. And so the logic on barriers, on suicide bridges, you know, magnet bridges. What I'm trying to say is that we really can be responsible for ourselves, put up a conceptual barrier wherein we realize some of the real problems with suicide, so that when our mind goes there, we can sort of say to ourselves, no, you know, you can't just deny depression or sadness, but you can deny a behavior. You can't say, no, I'm not going to do that.
And the other piece that you can do when you are in a reasonably okay place is pay attention to the kinds of things that you're talking about in the book and that we're talking about today, the history and the logic, and expand the way that you think about it. I talked to one of the few Golden Gate Bridge suicide survivors a little bit ago, and he was talking about on his way to jump over this 4-foot high wall, which is, you know, unfortunately not a hard thing to do, all he could feel was pain, and that's all he could think about. And that had there been a net, I mean, he fortunately was saved, but most of the people were not. And again, it is a permanent cure for what may not be a permanent experience or a permanent moment.
You know, we all know that wonderful phrase, and it sounds so true, but when you feel terrible, one of the characteristics of depression is that you can't see outside it.
Right.
You just forget having felt better. So that, you know, one of the I didn't make this up, one of the letters I got thanking me for these ideas said that one of the things this guy does is write himself a note when he's feeling happy and just say, I'm feeling good right now. And when he feels terrible, he said to me, sometimes it's only the fact that it's in his handwriting. You know, he just has he doesn't even feel like he could believe it. But he said, oh, there it is. So this isn't how I'm always. But let's just look at the two main historical and sociologically sound arguments that I found. The first one is community.
Yes.
And the bedrock of that is that suicide can be fatal to other people because suicide is so influential. In many ways. That's right. The first is just the actual, that a person can be influenced towards taking their life, and that when someone in a school does it, it's more likely that we'll see it again in that school. If someone in a given profession does it, sometimes the profession starts to respond. When a celebrity does it, that can cause more suicide in that age and gender. Across the nation. So we really do respond to it being sort of like us. And what people need to know is that this can be a very powerful force that can lead you to do something you don't want to do.
Indeed.
Just think about how we feel independent, but we smoke if our friends are smoking and
right.
we quit when they quit.
That's right.
And if our friends have three kids instead of two this decade, we go with that. I mean, huge life decisions. And it's very difficult to balk against those. And so that we have to ask ourselves ahead of time whether we can notice this happening in our lives, that if we've heard about some suicides, if we've experienced friends who have, to know that there may be a part of our brain who's going to want to do this. And sometimes it's going to feel like that part is in control.
Yeah.
But the rest of you has to stand up to it. You don't want your worst mood to murder all your others.
And with that, Jennifer Michael Hecht, we're going to take a break and we're going to come back. We will continue to discuss with Jennifer her book, Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Again, if this is a subject that strikes you in a way that you think will not be good for you to listen, you can always go to mindtalk.org and hear the conversation at some other time. So take care of yourself as you're listening and learning. We'll be right back. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk and a continuation of the conversation with Jennifer Michael Hecht, who is a poet, a philosopher, a historian, a commentator. She's the author of several bestsellers. Today's focus is her book entitled Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. One of the things, Jennifer, that you say very early in the book that I'd just like to to put out on the table is that you're very clear that you do not mean to pass judgment on those who have committed suicide. You say that instead you wish to express to the suicidal person who has rejected suicide that that person deserves gratitude from your community and from humanity.
That's right. I do want to say, you know, there's someone listening out there right now who's decided that the people around them would be so damaged for life if they were to do this, that this person who's listening is staying alive for other people. And I want you to know that your culture is grateful. I'm going to be the one voicing it right now. I'm grateful. Thank you for staying. You're my hero. I know how hard it is. And I'm impressed and grateful. In terms of the blame thing, I feel like it would be like blaming a 14th century Chinese little girl for binding her feet. You know, the culture negotiates a lot of these things for us. And what we're suggesting here is that we can think our way into new behaviors. But there's certainly, I only have the greatest heartache for anyone who died without having heard some of these historical arguments. I mean, look, these historical arguments have already helped me. So I know it's a real thing that you can get help from them. So, yes, I do feel that it's possible that if someone who had passed had read, what Camus says about it or what Wittgenstein said about it, that perhaps it would have given them the strength they needed to get through the worst time. But that still doesn't amount to anything like blame. It's not the kind of decision you make. And the truth is, look, when physical pain is bad enough and it's terminal, that's not even suicide. That's end of life management. Mm-hmm. And it is imaginable that a psychological pain could be that bad. But use this as a rule. If you're a doctor and you're parents or spouse or children or friends, depending on where you are in life, if everybody thinks that maybe you've had enough and this is a reasonable choice for you, well, then you need your case to be adjudicated or thought about separately from mm-hmm. a larger question, right? Mm-hmm. But most people who we're talking about in terms of suicide, we're talking about despair suicide, and we're talking about people whose friends and family would do anything to save them, whose friends and family truly believe that if they could just stay, next year would be a lot better.
Indeed.
And so we can sort of draw those loose categories and say, look, in 2012, more military killed themselves than died in either Afghanistan or Iraq, combat or transportation accidents. I mean, it's staggering. And a full third of them were never deployed.
That was one of the things that I found really fascinating and troubling on so many levels. A third of them were never deployed.
Right. The thing that we don't usually hear when we hear these numbers is that these numbers are not so, they're not out of the norm for that age and gender category mm-hmm. in the regular population. It's just that the Army used to be protective. People used to live in groups. They had barracks and they had communal rooms. And while those weren't fun on any given day, you'd rather be alone. The truth is that human beings do better when they're in groups. Not mm-hmm. that we know this for sure, but I've certainly read some military psychologists who have suggested that this may be part of why we're not seeing that protection mm-hmm. that we had seen in the past. Mm-hmm. The thing is, I was so moved to hear from a couple of different soldiers and ex-soldiers. One I'll share because he published it on the Daily Beast online, saying that he had lost two, he was an ex-Army Ranger who had lost two friends to suicide who were ex-Army Rangers, and he wanted so much to do something about it, but he didn't know what to do, mm-hmm. and he was so sad, and he wasn't taking care of himself either, and he was sort of spiraling, and then he lost a third friend to suicide. Mm-hmm. And just at that point, he read something that Gideon's Stay, something that David Brooks in the New York Times had quoted. And he read this paragraph or so that's in Stay, where I end with the line, if you want your niece to make it through her dark night of the soul, you have to make it through yours.
Yeah.
And he wrote, and that was what opened his eyes and made him realize. He changed it, I thought, brilliantly. It's, if you want your ex-Army Ranger to make it through his dark night of the soul, you have to make it through yours.
Mm-hmm.
And he followed that up by saying, so I'm going to start accepting the help that's being offered and take care of my own stuff so that the cycle doesn't start again.
How powerful. Yeah.
Oh, just such a strong, wonderful, thoughtful, and giving man. And he wasn't taking care of himself because he was putting himself sort of last on the list. And he was being manly and brave and things that we really admire. But at some point, it's so good that he could see that it was being manly and brave to take care of his own stuff.
Right.
And that's what we sometimes need help seeing. Our whole culture just keeps saying, get help, which is right. Everyone, if you're in trouble, get help. But somebody has to tell you why. You know, more than half of the suicides on campuses are not, those students are not clients of the mental health facility. They just don't go.
Yeah.
They feel, you know, they don't want to take up time. Some of it is that they're just such good people, and they are. If you haven't thought about what suicide could do to other people, sometimes it's the really good-hearted person who says, I'm a burden. I'm not perfect.
Right.
I can't get the grades they want me to get. I'm not, I can't get the boyfriend or the girlfriend that I feel like I should have now, and I'm a failure. Let me get out of the way. And those people, I hear from them too, letters and emails saying, until I saw from the statistics that you quote,
exactly,
that you're such a bigger burden if you kill yourself. Sure, you're a burden. Every human being is a burden at some point, if not all the time, right? And sometimes you're a terrible burden. Each one of us is sometimes ill or depressed in a way that makes our loved ones have to work harder and around us.
Yeah.
But what I hear, I sure hear it from men with children who hadn't quite walked themselves through that.
Uh-huh.
They even think, I'm depressed and I don't have a job and I'm just sapping everybody's energy.
Exactly.
If I kill myself, my wife will remarry. My kids will have a much better father with more money and happiness. It'll be great. And they don't think through, no, my kids will have a father who had killed himself. And that's what they're going to take from that. And that's what they're going to live with their whole lives. And indeed, statistics, and we have good studies that show that if you have kids under 18 and you kill yourself, those kids are at least double as likely, at least twice as likely to kill themselves. And what age they are when you do it changes when and how often they do it. If they're very young and you think, oh, they didn't even remember you, when they find out about it, so there's a 5-year gap where they're not suicidal when they're that young when it happens. And then their suicidality increases exponentially the rest of their lives. Whereas the ones who are old enough to deal with it while it happens, they tend to kill themselves that year or the year after, but then it starts to level off. So we're really talking about how much we know feeling bad can be miserable, but you don't want to hand that certainly to your kids. The thing is, the letters I get where fathers are telling me, oh, now I know I'm not going to do it, they're not just grateful that they're not going to make this mistake.
Mm-hmm.
They're grateful they don't have to think about it anymore. And that happened to me too. I felt I felt burdened by having to think about, should I act on these thoughts or am I not going to act on these thoughts?
Uh-huh.
And as soon as I saw, oh, I'm never going to act on these thoughts, I really could emotionally experience it much more like we all have homicidal thoughts now and again, right? A little road rage when someone cuts you off.
Absolutely.
But we don't go and act. We don't even bother ourselves about, should I go and act on that, right?
We just don't.
We know,
right,
not just is it illegal, but we know the person we want to be wouldn't do that.
Right.
Right, and we just walk away from it. And that's also what I'm hearing from people in these letters. So these people actually write letters. I mean, it's so moving. And they say, this transforms how they place the conversation. So it's no longer on them to figure this thing out. Mm-hmm. And our culture is just doing a bad job of this. Most cultures, they don't always do it for the best, in the best way. So sometimes they'll say, you know, that if you kill yourself, you're going to hell or something.
Right.
So that may not be the most contemplative or kind way, but it does get people through that one bad night. We have records of it through the millennia, some of which I put in the book of, you know, how this middle-aged woman, you know, from the Middle Ages, says that she fought through the night with mm-hmm. God trying to save her and the mm-hmm. devil trying to get her to kill herself, and she mm-hmm. was holding the knife the whole night, and that by the end of the night, God won. And, you know, there are many people today who don't have that kind of
indeed
vision of, yeah, of belief, and so when they're struggling holding a knife, it's all by themselves. Well, I'm trying to hand them the philosophical and social science ideas that helped me and so many other people now to feel like that's not their burden. They're not alone. You're not alone. We asked 26,000 college students,
wow,
whether they'd ever thought about suicide, and 26,000, 55% said they'd thought about it. And
55%.
We asked how many had seriously thought about it, and it was 30%. It's just astounding because our culture doesn't talk about it, right?
So right, think, not at all.
We think if you have that thought, you must be a little mentally ill. Well, by definition, if more than half of human beings, and these are college kids, right? They're mm-hmm. somewhat privileged. They're, right. Their lives are ahead of them. They're young still. They don't groan when they stand up like I do. But you know, they are already feeling this, which means Americans especially have to stop pretending that life is so happy. Life is good. Life
yeah.
is worth living. Life is meaningful. It's deep. It's precious. And sometimes it's full of joy. But it's also, it can be so hard and so sad for everybody. And we have to fold that back into our expectations.
And then in doing that, then we are better able to really craft for ourselves ways that we want to deal with it. One of the things that happens in the book that can, I would think, be confusing to some folks is the conversations that you go through in great detail about how some said that Jesus Christ, in fact, was a suicide, that he
sure.
did not do anything to prevent his death. So that was a suicide. And then you also give a great deal of space to St. Augustine in particular, a North African theologian, who says, but although Jesus Christ's death was voluntary, no one else's should be.
Yeah, it was very confusing for the early Christians. You know, in John, Jesus says, no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down myself. So this language, clearly, it's not what we normally think of as a suicide. It's a very different kind of an action. But there have been historians and the great theologians. I mean, there are no greater theologians in early Christianity than St. Augustine and almost 1,000 years later, Thomas Aquinas, Saint Thomas Aquinas. So, but you know what they were saying was, yeah, Jesus made this choice himself, but we're not. No one else is allowed to. And the reason that it's so important, and I don't give too much space to this conversation, but so much I do give a lot of space to the martyrs afterwards, because what happens is, Christianity is being persecuted in its first couple hundred years, and so there are martyrs, and there are also suicide martyrs. People are going along with the martyrs who are being killed by the Roman emperor by taking their own life and saying they're doing it in solidarity. But after 313, when the Emperor Constantine makes Christianity legal, those other kinds of martyrdom disappear.
Jennifer, let me interrupt you. We're going to
sure.
take a break. And when we come back, we're going to pick up right here.
Sure.
So, folks, relax. Don't go away. Again, if this is a conversation that you're having some difficulty with, you can always listen to it later on at mindtalk.org. I hope you will stay with us. But if that is too hard, then take care of yourself and do not. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Hello, folks. This is Pamela Brewer continuing the conversation with poet, philosopher, and historian Jennifer Michael Hecht, author of Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Jennifer, one of the things that you point out is that St. Augustine, in the year approximately 400, which was after Christianity was legalized, correct?
Right.
He makes the point that the commandment, thou shalt not kill man, includes killing yourself.
Right. Yeah, he even points out that if God had wanted to save thy neighbor, he clearly knew how to save thy neighbor.
Right.
In the other commandments, he makes that point. So yes, and that's, you know, that's very helpful for people who can respond in that way to that kind of a rule. There's nothing wrong with that at all. You know, what happened in the medieval period was because of this sort of craze for martyrdom, the church started to notice that there were too many people doing this, and they started to make suicide, especially if you were doing it for ostensibly pious reasons. If you said you were, you know, martyring yourself for Christianity, that was excommunicatable, and then you had to be buried outside the churchyard. And then eventually the church was torturing the corpses and confiscating the estate so that the family of a suicide would be destitute. So
what do you mean torturing the corpses?
They literally, if you killed yourself, they drawn and quartered. Drawn means they tie a rope to the corpse and have a horse drag it to its final resting place, which would either be at the crossroads outside town, or they would just hang the body in the town square and let birds and dogs get it. It was just disgusting, and but it certainly was a deterrent. People spoke of it, people wrote of it, and the thing is that when we get to the modern age and we get to the Enlightenment and people are starting to write about how we want to be civilized and we don't want to have any bodies exposed to the elements and things like that, the problem is that people start to attack the whole idea of being against suicide as being a kind of religious overstatement. So the great philosopher David Hume wrote a piece on suicide, which I just think was too flip. You know, he was just saying the church should have nothing to say about this, and if you don't feel happy, you should be able to just kill yourself. And, you know, not a deep response to what killing yourself could be,
right,
but really responding to that the church shouldn't have anything to do with this. And I really think that the secular world took a wrong turn here. And secularists who might be listening, we make mistakes sometimes. The Enlightenment thought we'd get rid of marriage because that was just the church controlling sex. Well, it turned out to be not all
right.
That marriage is.
Right.
It's something beautiful that's a beautiful cultural thing that we've created and we're trying to change and deal with and live with, but we don't want to get rid of. Likewise, the church has always been against murder, but we agree. Right now, it's not like the secular world ever really thought it would get rid of that prohibition, but the secular world did think it was going to get rid of marriage, for instance, and some other things that turned out to be more human than religious. And the prohibition against suicide is one that most cultures throughout most of history have found a way to say to people, you don't always remember how important you are.
Yeah.
Sometimes the culture and your community remembers how important you are, but can't convince you right now.
Right.
But you have to trust your culture a little bit. Look, when we're adolescents, right, and we're on a train, and we look and we see all those houses, and they're all the same, and we think, oh, my God, I don't want to grow up and just get a house with a family like everybody else. And you grow up, and you're like, I get a house? I get a family? Someone's going to love me? I'm going to conceive? The children are going to be born? Okay. You realize your culture knew stuff you didn't know.
Right.
That this is a pretty good life if you can get it. But as a teenager, you didn't know yet how the depth of the love and the feeling and what kind of art you could create in that house or what kind of meals or love or manage things. The point is we do have to do a little bit of that cultural work in our culture. And I want everyone who's listening to join me in the talking about this, in being brave enough to say, sometimes I have those thoughts, or I know people who are having those thoughts and who are struggling with it. It's common, not just to say to get help, but to say, let's stop saying that it's everybody's decision. You know, certainly in most philosophy classes across this country, people are taught that suicide is an autonomous decision,
mm-hmm.
that it's almost a pillar of our autonomy. Look how I'm alive because I want to be, because I could always
mm-hmm.
stop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe that's not a right we need, like we need the mm-hmm. right to free speech.
Yeah.
Maybe sometimes you need also the responsibility of looking around and saying, both, I'm responsible for the other sad people around me. I'm responsible for my community. I'm responsible for my family. And I'm also responsible for my future self, which needs you to be strong right now. You know, I know there are people listening right now who were suicidal 10 years ago and who
yeah.
are glad
All
it
right.
didn't happen. And sometimes we have to keep our eyes on that. And sometimes making this decision, just make it before you get into the terrible place, because the
exactly.
terrible place is not a logical place.
Right.
When you get there, you do have to say to yourself, some days my whole job is just waiting. Just wait until you feel a little better, then make plans. You don't have to fix your life when you're feeling at your worst.
And you shouldn't try, quite frankly.
Right. Just rest. Yeah, get help if you can.
Right.
But you right now don't need to fix everything. You need to feel better. Our moods... Emerson, the great writer, Ralph Waldo Emerson, said, "Our moods do not believe in each other," and we have to keep that in mind.
Absolutely, and you know, I think a couple of things as we're talking. Well, I think many things as we're talking.
Sure.
But I'll try to do one sentence at a time.
Mm.
One of the things that comes to mind in America certainly is that there is a huge push and ongoing, not new, push and appreciation and celebration of the individual.
Yeah.
So as you're thinking about the value of the individual, if that's really your focus, it can be hard to step outside of that and look at your value to the community and to
yeah.
humanity as a whole.
Absolutely.
And maybe that's
Absolutely.
A place where we kind of got, I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I think it's absolutely critical that you look at and take responsibility for yourself. On the other hand, you can kind of forget that there are other people who maybe don't see you the way you see yourself and who actually do care about you and do love you and do feel the need to have you present and in their lives.
Right. You bring up such these are subtle and complicated issues, and of course we're that's why I'm so glad that I have the book to offer as well, because we can only touch on these things. But
mm-hmm.
you know, the experience that we have in modern America, it's like a fantasy of what most human beings throughout most of history have wanted. We each have our own room. We have climate control. We have enough food most of the time. We have entertainment, endless entertainment, without being bothered by other human beings. I mean, we voted with our feet to have this kind of anonymity and privacy mm-hmm. and independence, but it's not good for us all the time.
And
We just, you know, we human beings, our culture came up after 100,000 years of having to all huddle around the same fire and be together. And now we have to sometimes make sure we do that for ourselves, both conceptually and in real life.
Absolutely. And, you know, I also think about the well-known people. There are many well-known people, as many of us know, who have talked about the fact that they've been depressed. And so I think about Halle Berry and Oprah Winfrey, and there
yeah.
are people who love Britney Spears, and there are people
right.
who think, oh my goodness, where'd she come from? But there are people who love her.
Of
and
course.
There are so many people of significance in our lives. Imagine if an Oprah Winfrey or a Halle Berry or a Britney Spears said, although Britney tries, I think, in a lot of ways, but said, you know what, I'm done.
Right.
I'm done. I'm just going away. I mean, our lives as a community, as a planet, would be so different, and we
yes,
would have
it would
so
break
much
our hearts.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, especially people who were doing so well at some of the virtues that we have a lot of experience knowing usually can get you through. So, you know, Oprah, for whatever one thinks of a range of aspects about her, she is engaged in helping other people. Maybe she does it wrong some of the time, but she is engaged in that process. And that's one of the few things that we know reliably really does help you in life. It just helps you to take your own self a little less seriously and helps you to remember that you can do tiny things, even if you have almost no energy or mobility or money or anything, to help other people. That tends to be very strengthening. So I think if we lost somebody like Britney Spears that way, it would be very painful. But Oprah, that would kill us. I mean, that would really hurt. Mm-hmm. That you'd have a lot of people losing hope because she represents different things. But you know, the overall thing of how, what I found, this was really, I think, the first insight I found, was that the loss of my friends hurt so much, even though we weren't in touch for a while. You know, we were not very close anymore. We had known each other a while back, and we kept seeing each other over the ensuing years, and we were still friends. And I love them, but no, these weren't active, constant relationships at all. And so that realization that if they meant so much to me from afar, oh my God, I must mean so much to other people. And that, I feel like, is a muscle you can exercise, feeling the invisible community around you. And you can feel it. You can pluck that that invisible string and hear the note by thinking just what you just described. What would it feel like to me if I lost this person? You suddenly realize, oh, it wouldn't just be about losing this person. It would be about what that means about life.
Absolutely. Folks, we are talking about suicide. I am talking with Jennifer Michael Hecht, the author of many books, including Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. My name is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk. We're going to take a very brief break. We will continue. And as you listen to today's conversation, maybe if you've never done it before, and maybe if you can do it today, maybe you can start listing some of those things that you really love about yourself. And keep that close on a piece of paper, on a notepad, in your own handwriting. That would be a wonderful thing. We'll be right back. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We continue the conversation with Jennifer Michael Hecht. You know, Jennifer, certainly in today's world, there are so many views about who's a terrorist, what a terrorist is, and what a terrorist isn't. And you, I think, importantly quote the Quran as stating that killing is not okay. You mm-hmm. quote an article on the Muslim Public Affairs. I think it's from the Muslim Public Affairs Council, mm-hmm. as describing suicide as ugly, anti-Islam, anti-nature, and anti-life. Even mm-hmm. in the case of severe depression, it is a sin. And you make the point that for Islam to have come to be associated with a religion that that Islam as a religion that so emphatically legislates in favor of life, for it mm-hmm. to come associated with something so anti-life, is really kind of interesting. What do we do about these flips in our life that tell us, it's almost a repeat of what you were talking about earlier. You know, things get flipped and you're told that yeah. suicide is, at least in a part of our society, that that's the thing you do. You martyr yourself. It's
right.
a good thing.
Right.
But in fact, that
right.
is absolutely opposed.
It's such an important question, and I think one of the interesting ways to look at it is, you know, why can these young people be convinced? And we know part of it is that they don't feel like they have any opportunities, so mm. it's the despair side. But the other side counts, too, which is that they are really convinced over and over that they're going someplace. So they're mm-hmm. escaping a very difficult world, mm-hmm. but they can use that word escape, because escape means to go from a dangerous place to a safe one. Mm. You can't escape into the grave. The grave is not where you're going to find your reunions and your rehabilitations. You're not going to make up for mistakes there. You have to do all that stuff here with us. The thing is that people get, it's tricky with religion. Look, I think if a sad person has a good religion and a community around them that is helping them, that can be a terrific way of structuring life and meaning and staying alive. But the truth is that many people either don't believe in God or in that kind of God.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, many, many people have these spiritual understandings of the world, but they don't believe that there's anything that's making rules for human beings. And so even though they feel spiritual, they don't have anything saying no. So, and we also know that suicide can be profoundly influential in the way that people start dreaming that a person who's killed themselves is calling them over, especially a family
yeah.
member.
Yeah.
So, I talk about some in the book of some of the famous writers and artists who's, you know, Spalding Gray, the great playwright and monologist, his mother took her life, and mm-hmm. he wrote about how he felt his whole life that she was sort of calling to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he eventually took his own life as well, which is so sad. He struggled against it, but he got in a car accident, which made life yet more painful.
Yes.
And that's when he sort of lost that struggle. But we know that if you have an image of an afterlife where it's this kind of shiny reward, it's much easier to convince yourself that you don't have to think about this problem very carefully. But the notion that the greatest opportunity for really knowing anything about heaven for us here is to try to take care of each other. And that is something that this kind of a violent exit is just, it's just, You're only going to think that's the way that things can work if you really, it's terrible, but it's ignorance. Violence just doesn't work. And I believe right. that's true many times when the United States does violence, too, that you just create more martyrs and more people in pain. But certainly in the case of suicide bombers, when they're walking into play, I mean, it's just the worst thing that a humane soul needs to do.
And that's the thing, a humane soul. But, you know, again, religion puts an interesting complexity on all of these things, because for some, they believe that is what their religion is telling them to do. You also make the point that First Nation communities are particularly hard hit by suicide clusters.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, it's just, the situation on, if I can quote my First Nation friend on the res, is just too depressing and too, there's just too much death and alcoholism and just lack of opportunity and the pain of knowing the history. And the problem is that when we see it rises for the same reason as all these other communities we've been talking about, which is that someone does it and then it gets contagious for a little while. So we see these terrible blips that are mother's sons and daughters. These are real, it's that's the part that I keep, it's hard for me to express. Look, even if what's happening in the rise of suicide right now is not a response to the economy, because it started before the economy crashed. The economy isn't helping. But if it started before the wars, because after all, as we saw, the number of people deployed isn't what matches the suicide. If we see, okay, some of this is just a trend that suicide goes up and down. If you think about the numbers, we just for this trend to complete its little role, we're going to lose hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, if we lose 40,000 Americans a year, and those people wouldn't die if we were at a different moment in the cycle, and there's a logic for that, right? That if they hadn't heard of and known a few suicides, it would be less in their mind as a reasonable way forward. And so we influence each other in this terrible way, and then at some point it seems to ebb, like the culture just has enough, and then it starts again later on these 10 to 20 year cycles. And you don't want to be that guy. And these ideas that are in stay, this conversation, for me, I felt researching and writing the book made me part of a community in a way I never thought it would. I just now I talk to these other people online in the public community forums. I hear them talking. They're talking to each other. I'm listening and learning. And there's this feeling of there being some purpose. And the purpose seems so small, but it's so large. It's people who are willing to say, you know what? I experience pain sometimes. Come sit by me. Let's have a beverage together and say, yeah, this is the community of the struggling. We may be more than half, and let's try to take care of each other. And I found it to be such a warm and meaningful and sometimes challenging, but a whole new part of my life came up from being just a little bit more vocal about this, being willing to say these things, being willing to listen, and even to change my mind. I certainly started this project, before I went through this whole experience. I thought what everyone else does in sort of progressive, educated world, that this is morally neutral. And now I think, you know what? I think I'm willing to say suicide is wrong. Let's rethink what it means to find meaning and purpose.
As we wind up our conversation today, and unfortunately we must, but that won't keep me from bringing you back on again, if you are willing.
Great, absolutely.
What, if there's a thought or a concept that you really want people to walk away with from our conversation today, what would it be?
I guess it would definitely be the sharing of this kind of conversation. Yeah, we need to start talking. We need to challenge the notion that suicide is everyone's right. It's not a right like everyone else, like all those other rights. We need to be willing to support each other emotionally, just by saying, I'm not one of these super depressed people who you would hear about only in a certain way. I'm not somebody who's suffering in these obvious ways, but yeah, me too. And that's what I wrote the book for. It helps us have some language to have this conversation without it being too scary, because we're talking about some facts that we can talk about which seem to help people to know.
So, in other words, you want us to stay.
I want you to stay.
Thank you so much. Jennifer Michael Hecht, author of Stay, A History of Suicide and the Philosophies Against It. Jennifer, how can folks find out more about all the things that you're doing and all the writings that you do and have done?
Thanks. My website is jennifermichaelhecht.com. My last name is H-E-C-H-T. But I bet if you put in Jennifer Michael and stay, you'll get to my website. And yes, please. And my email is there. You can write to me. I'm glad to hear from people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jennifer,
thank
for
you.
Your time today. Folks, this is Dr. Pamela Brewer, and I thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk. And remember, you can always listen to this conversation again at mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications for Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. Special thanks to production assistance provided by Sophie Durow and LaDonna Smith. Thank you both very much. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. And folks, you remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.